And now, the romance of Helen Trent. Once again, the makers of Benefax Multivitamins present The Romance of Helen Trent, the story of a woman who found that when life seemed finished, over, she could still recapture romance at 35 and even beyond. Gil Whitney, to whom Helen is engaged, and who must spend several months in a wheelchair until he can walk again, is convalescing at his home outside of Hollywood with Bugsy O'Toole as his nurse and general handyman, and his younger sister Marge as his house guest from Indiana. Every afternoon at 5, when Helen finishes her work as chief gown designer at Parafilm Studios, she hurries out to Gil's to have dinner and spend some time with him. And tonight should be an especially nice, peaceful evening for them, because Marjorie has flown back to Indiana to spend the weekend with her children. But the evening, starting off now, is not going to be peaceful at all. For today, Helen's long-accumulated disappointment reached a peak in her. A disappointment that Gil keeps insisting they delay their wedding till he's well again. Helen, in an outburst of angry tears, said to Agatha Anthony, with whom she lives,
"I'm going to talk to Gil Whitney tonight, like I've never talked to him before. I'm going to ask him one more time, just once, this last time, to marry me and let us possess our happiness. I'll use every trick in the book to coax him and force him out of his foolish attitude. I'll cry and wheedle and if necessary, stand on my head. But I guarantee you this time I'll get results. And I should have taken this stand long before now."
By the time Helen got out to Gil's, she was calm again, very self-possessed and quiet. But she's waited her chance to speak, and now it's come. With dinner over, the two are sitting together in the lamplit living room. Gil has put his wheelchair next to the phonograph and is playing for Helen an old record of April in Paris, which was one of her favorite tunes several years ago. And Helen has just been telling him of the wedding this afternoon of one of her co-workers at the studio, Betty Fairfax.
You know, 3 months have gone by since you got out of the hospital, Gil, and we've done nothing about it. But in that same length of time, Betty Fairfax has met and married the man she loves. You see, not all people are spendthrifts with time like we are.
Please, sweetheart, don't begin on that again.
I'm not beginning now. I'm finishing, Gil. And you're going to listen. You're lucky I blew off all my steam and temper on Agatha tonight, so now I can be a little calmer with you. Look, Gil, this is June, and already we've thrown 3 months away. I'm now announcing to you one fact, and I mean every word of it. Gil, you're going to marry me this month or never. Do you understand that? Now, in June, or not at all.
Sweetheart, why this sudden outburst?
Because all of a sudden I'm sick to death of living for a future that never comes and chucking the present into the wastebasket. Why, you and I might as well be in the first stages of a courtship as the way we are now. I'm away from you all day long, and I rush out here at night. And can we have a meal alone together? Can we even find a place to sit and talk alone together? No, Bugsy's around and Marjorie's around, and people are coming and going, and I can hardly be close to you. So I'm starving a little. And I'm getting more and more angry and fed up and tired and disgusted with the whole thing.
Helen, do you think I don't feel the same way, too?
And furthermore, I'm getting terribly embarrassed at my doing all the urging about this. I think it flatters a woman any to propose to her fiancé at least once a day, every day in the week. I'm stopping it right now, Gil. This is my full time, and you can say yes or no. I think you're mean.
Oh, Helen, please. Now, wait a second, my darling.
Why can't I be taking care of you? I'm the logical one to do it, aren't I? I could do my work and look after you, and life would be a beautiful thing. It's only for a while you'll be this way. And you won't even give me the privilege of helping you when you need me most. We could have all the long, lovely days together. It'll be something. Something sweet. We remember all our lives. And instead, you're keeping me on the outside where I can hardly look in. I can't even plan a meal for you, or get you your medicine, or even arrange the flowers here in your house. Marjorie and Bugsy beat me to it, and I just come out and visit in the evening. And it's empty and lonesome. And I hate it. I hate it.
I'm sorry you resent so much Marjorie staying here, Helen. But after all, she is my sister. She is newly widowed. She has no money. Would you want me to completely turn her away?
I don't resent Marjorie. I just think you could make some other arrangement about her. You know she gets on your nerves and constantly tears down all convalescing you do.
Nonsense.
That's the truth, you know it. Your own doctor said so. Now you're going to let her children come out for the summer, which will give you no peace and quiet at all, and you'll be longer than ever getting well so we can be married. Oh, you see, Gil, you see my point. The time has come when if we're ever going to be married, we've got to do it despite hindrances. There'll always be hindrances. The time will never arrive when everything's just perfect. Oh, I'm fed up, I tell you. I'm completely fed up. And turn off that record. I've had enough of memories in the old days. We're in the present now, we're going to stay in it.
Very well, darling. Now, Helen, let's take one thing at a time. May I say a word now? First of all, about Marjorie. I hate to say so, but I'd prefer to be rid of her, too. She means well, but she's too difficult to live peaceably with. I told her I could give her a reasonable allowance to live on at home, but she's not satisfied with that. She wants to stay here in California. For the time being, I feel compelled to give in to her. I'm all she has in the world, and I cannot and I will not shirk my duty to my only sister and her youngsters. I couldn't look myself in the face if I didn't do what I could for sis.
Well, let her stay here in California, Gil. She and the children could have my apartment in town if I were married to you and living out here. Said we'd keep my place in town anyway for the sake of convenience.
Sweetheart, Marjorie's not what's keeping us from being married. The fact that I'm stuck here in this wheelchair is as clod-like as a tree stump. Not only a cent of money, heaven only knows how long it'll be before I can get back to my law practice.
Money needn't enter into it at all, Gil.
You can say that, darling, but maybe I feel differently about it.
That's the first time I've ever mentioned finances. So now we have a new hindrance to add to all the others. Money. If you try hard, maybe you could add the weather, too.
Helen, it isn't kind of you to talk that way. Look, dear, you've never seemed to be able to see this at all. Try to understand that a man who has to be lifted around like a baby doesn't feel like a man. He doesn't want to marry the woman of his dreams when he's as helpless as... when he's utterly helpless. The very thought of that makes him wince. Try to think a little of how I feel, Helen.
Oh, darling, to me, you're not helpless. And I love you more now than I ever have in my life. It'll be for such a short time, Gil. Only a few months it'll be this way. Why can't we take it in our stride and go on and live?
I want the first few months of our life together to be beautiful the way I've dreamed of it being, Helen.
You can't have everything in life turn out the way you've dreamed it. That's my whole point. There are a few times you have to compromise or lose out. This is one of them. I mean it, Gil. It's now, this month, or not at all.
You mean you'd break your engagement soon?
I don't need to go into detail, but I simply mean what I said.
Now you're certainly giving me something to worry about.
I'm sorry, but that's the stand I have to take.
Helen, has it occurred to you that something might go wrong with my convalescence and I'd never walk again?
Darling, will you stop looking for bugaboos? You know such a thing would never happen.
Such a thing might very likely happen. I don't expect it to, but it certainly could. I'd feel badly enough if you were married to a temporary invalid, but if you were married to a permanent one...
Gil, will you get this through your head? Nothing you do can wrong me. I'm asking to marry an invalid. I'm eager and anxious and yearning to. I want you just the way you are, or any way you're ever going to be. Because I love you more than all the rest of the world put together. Gil, you've got one bad fault. And I'm going to tell you what it is, darling. You're a perfectionist. You want everything to be perfect and ready before you make a move. That's an admirable quality in one way, and In another, it's utterly destructive. Because every plan in life is too uncertain. I'm ready to reach out and take what belongs to us and deal with the hindrances afterward. If you aren't ready, say so. You let the whole thing drop once and for all.
Are you saying you'll stop loving me?
I'm asking you the questions now. Can we be married right away, Gil? Or can't we?
How long do I have to decide on the answer?
No time. Not any. I want the answer right now.
Well, it's been a long time. We interrupt this program. We have interrupted this program to bring you another special invasion broadcast. We take you to London for the report of Edward R. Murrow. Go ahead, London.
Here is a summary of the latest news available at Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. There is no cause for pessimism. The beach opposition was less than had been expected. Our convoys did not come under serious attack. The minesweeping was good. It was a low tide landing. And the minesweepers did the most difficult job ever done by the little ships. They attacked the clear water, and they led the big ships in. There was no changing of course. They had to contend with a two-knot change in the tide right in the middle of the operation. That meant they were sweeping in a strong, hot tide. The weather has not been kind during the first phase of the operation. It was bad when the attack began, but the weathermen said it would improve. And they were right. Many of the men must have had an uncomfortable passage. The air cover had to go in low. But tonight it seems that the weathermen's right. The opinion here seems to be that we are over the first two or three hurdles, but there are many more to come. The American naval forces were able to silence the shore batteries at the point of landing, and our losses at sea have been very, very small. In the air, it is clear that the Luftwaffe has not given serious battle. Up to noon today, only about 50 enemy fighters have been seen. It is clear that the Germans haven't yet committed their air force, haven't yet made up their mind. It appears that the Allied air has done its job. Between midnight last night and the early hours of this morning, more than 31,000 airmen were over the target area. And that doesn't count the airborne troops. More than 1,000 heavy bombers were out last night. Then, more than 1,000 of our heavies went out at first light. After them went the mediums and the dive bombers. The lack of enemy response in the air is pleasing. But it is no cause for undue optimism. They still have a formidable fighter force. Their morale is still good. They just haven't made up their minds. They're waiting. I issued an order of the day, telling the Luftwaffe it must beat off this attack at all costs, even if the Luftwaffe is destroyed. But he has not yet thrown in his main force. The RAF 2nd Technical Air Force alone flew more than 2,000 sorties today, providing a fighter umbrella over the invasion beaches. Not a single enemy aircraft had been seen in the bridgehead area up to early afternoon. Returning pilots, who could see the ground operation, described the landing of troops and equipment as going like clockwork. One Spitfire pilot said, "I went through Dunkirk, and I am not ashamed to say that I cried with joy at the sights I saw today." One French flyer remarked, "We all felt as if we were on our way home at last, and it felt good." Prime Minister Churchill has just given House of Commons a rather full report on the fighting so far. Here's what he reported. The landing of troops on the broad front has been effective, and troops have penetrated several miles inland. Lodgements exist on a broad front. Losses are far less than we apprehended. Many dangers and difficulties which appeared at this time last night as extremely formidable are behind us. This operation is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. Airborne troops are well established, and the follow-up is proceeding very much less long than we expected. Mr. Churchill named locale fighting for the first time. He said,
There is even fighting proceeding in the town of Khan. And he indicated that the fighting was not heavy because, when referring to the situation at Khan, he said, the enemy now will probably try to concentrate in this area. In that event, heavy fighting will soon begin and will continue. Mr. Churchill said, there is fighting proceeding at various points.
We have captured various bridges, which are important, and which were not blown up. Mr. Churchill began his second report of the day to the Commons by saying,
he had sent us where the latest information is received. After speaking of unexpectedly low losses, he said, the resistance of the batteries has been greatly weakened by the bombing of the air forces, and the superior bombardment of our ships quickly reduced their power to dimensions which did not affect the problem. He called the landing of airborne troops a marvelous feat and said they were larger than anything there had been so far in the world. He said risks had to be taken in respect of the weather, but he declared that General Eisenhower's courage is equal to all the necessary decisions. He ended by saying, it is a most serious time that we are entering upon, and we enter upon it with our great allies, all in good heart and in good friendship. And the Commons cheered the Prime Minister's optimistic report. And now, with the immediate worry off our minds about just the getting of a foothold in Europe, it's not too soon to turn some attention to the political problems that liberation, particularly of France, is going to involve. One aspect of the political struggle for power in France was illuminated sharply this afternoon. Early in the afternoon, Marshal Pétain issued a proclamation to the people, urging them to do just exactly what the Germans want, namely, stay put and carry on with their normal job. Pétain's excuse is that any other course means reprisals and bloodshed. And just a few minutes ago, Charles de Gaulle, who is now in England, issued an appeal to France of an entirely different kind. An appeal to all Frenchmen to take the guns, help them wherever and whenever they can strike, and with every possible means. General de Gaulle said that the battle for France was in full swing and that Frenchmen must participate in defeating the already retreating enemy. He told them to sabotage and destroy the German defenses, evade German conscription, and mobilize their assistance to the Allied armies. He called upon Frenchmen to obey the orders of the French government, by which he meant the Committee of National Liberation in Algiers. And also to obey the orders of the properly delegated French officers. All the hypothetical situations, assumptions, and conflicts about the past few years will now soon be proven or disproven in the light of hard results inside France itself. Another report out of Germany casts some light on what may be our strategy in this new attack. This report says that the landings are designed to secure the port of Cherbourg for the landing of heavy equipment, and goes on to say that Allied parachute troops have been dropped at both sides of the base of the peninsula to pick it off. If this succeeds, the peninsula will fall to us by strangulation, with no way for German reinforcements to rush to the defense of that vital harbor. Whether or not this is so, Richard Hadelet noticed this morning when he was flying over that area that the coast of Normandy is a dead place, with not a truck or a motorcycle moving over its road. Meanwhile, there have been more reports, which we cannot yet confirm, to the effect that we have landed on the Channel Islands of Jersey Guernsey. There will be a communique out later on this evening, and we will see how much of this the Supreme High Command confirms. We return you now to Columbia in New York.
You have just heard Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's Chief of European News. Here in CBS World News headquarters in New York is Dick Edwards.
CBS now continues its reporting of the news of the Allied invasion of Europe. You may be interested to know that since 3:32 this morning, Eastern War Time, and in the more than 9 hours since then, we've devoted approximately 7 hours to invasion news and analysis. This has included the words of fighting men themselves, reports from eyewitness radio reporters, bulletins from the press associations, communiques from Supreme Allied Headquarters, and urgent messages of government leaders speaking to their people and to all the world. Those of you who've been listening are aware of the urgent pattern we're following, which is to recapture the time of any regular program on our schedule whenever fresh news comes in from the scene of action on this great day of liberation. We have necessarily repeated much of the news in summary form, but have brought you familiar programs in their regular places whenever even repetition has run its course. Fresh news will, of course, be broadcast at any moment within seconds of its receipt and without warning. Stay tuned to your CBS station for constant coverage of the latest news from every theater of the war. Prime Minister Churchill said in London tonight that Allied troops have penetrated in some cases several miles inland after effective landings on the French coast on a broad front. That's a bulletin, and another one just in from the United Press quotes the German DNB news agency as saying this evening that the invasion front has further widened. And Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring declared in an order of the day to the German Air Forces today that the invasion of Western Europe must be fought off, even if it means the death of the Luftwaffe. That is another bulletin just received in CBS World News headquarters from an enemy source, Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. Thousands of Allied bombing planes softened up the defenses of Western Europe for the Anglo-American invasion armies last night and early today, dropping more than 11,200 tons of high explosives down on the Nazi coastal fortifications in 8.5 hours of furious attack. The roar of the bursting bombs and the motors of attacking fighter planes rolled back across the narrow straits of Dover incessantly from midnight until 8 a.m. Some 7,500 Allied planes hammered at the network of enemy gun emplacements studding the Channel coast. By mid-morning, the Allied air fleets had swept the skies clear of Nazi planes, and fighters were racing as far as 75 miles inland without drawing a challenge from the battered Luftwaffe. That brings to mind bulletin which came in a moment ago from Hermann Göring, who declared in an order of the day to the German air forces that the invasion of Western Europe must be fought off, even if it means the death of his vaunted Luftwaffe. Allied invasion forces so far have met less resistance than expected, both in the approaches of the beachheads and in the air. That is from the United Press. And although detailed reports of the situation are lacking still, it's summed up by one observer with the words, "We have gotten over the first 5 or 6 hurdles." And in a broadcast to his homeland, General Charles de Gaulle today called on French patriots to extend all possible aid to the Allied armies and, above all, to do everything not to be taken prisoner by the Germans. His talk, heard over CBS, brought home to the French the fact that their forces never before have had such a glorious opportunity to distinguish themselves. And from London, General Wilhelm Hanstein, the commander-in-chief of the Norwegian underground, broadcast an order to all organized fighting groups inside Norway to be prepared to take part in the Great Settlement, as he put it. Hanstein told his countrymen that they would receive orders on what to do. "You must not act openly except in conjunction with the Allied military plan," he said, "and not before orders have been issued from London." Prime Minister Churchill conferred with King George at the Buckingham Palace luncheon today, and then both visited General Dwight Eisenhower at his headquarters. The King and Churchill also met with other Allied invasion commanders, and they received late reports coming in from the beachheads in northern France. President Roosevelt spent the early tense morning hours of the invasion writing a prayer, which he will read to the nation over all radio networks tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern wartime. CBS, of course, will carry his broadcast. After his fireside chat last night, the president went to his bedroom on the second floor of the White House. Between telephone calls from the War Department telling of the progress of the action, the president wrote a prayer which he wants the country to join in tonight. The prayer has been released for publication, and so that the country might know it and will be able to join with Mr. Roosevelt tonight in praying for victory and for safety for the American forces in this greatest of all military undertakings. Now, another summary of the invasion news to this point. Allied forces landed in the Normandy area of northwest France this morning and have thrust several miles inland against unexpectedly slight German opposition and with losses much smaller than had been anticipated. The grand assault, scheduled for yesterday but postponed until today because of bad weather, found the highly vaunted German defenses much less formidable in every department than had been feared. Airborne troops who led the assault before daylight on a history-making scale suffered extremely small losses in the air, that's what headquarters tells us, even though the great plane fleets extended across 200 miles of sky and used navigation lights to keep formation. Naval losses for the seaborne forces are described at headquarters as very, very small, although 4,000 ships and several thousand smaller craft participated in taking the American, Canadian, and British troops to France. Coastal batteries were virtually silent for the guns of the British, American, and Allied fleets, including battleships, and the beachheads were speedily consolidated. The German radio said the scene of the landings was a 100-mile stretch of coast from Cherbourg to Le Havre, around the Bay of the Seine and the northeast shore of the Normandy Peninsula. Prime Minister Churchill, in announcing the successful invasion of the House of Commons at noon, 6 hours after the first seaborne troops landed, said the landings were the first of a series. Churchill disclosed that 11,000 Allied planes were available as needed for the battle. The Allied bombers, climaxing 96 hours of steady pounding, lashed German coastal defenses this morning with 10,000 tons of explosives. Fighters who went out to guard the beaches had little to do, however, as the German air forces up until noon had flown only 50 sorties against the invading forces. And as we told you a moment ago, the Prime Minister issued another communique from his headquarters this afternoon to say that things were indeed going at least as well and in some cases better than expected. The Germans were known for probably 1,750 fighters and 500 bombers to meet the attack today, but they did not use them in the start, and why they didn't was apparent. The Allied airman warned that a violent reaction may be expected soon, noting that Hermann Göring, in that order of the day, has told his air forces the invasion must be beaten off, even if the Luftwaffe perishes. And the Nazi-operated Paris radio, quoting a last-minute flash from the battlefield, this is a German report, said tonight that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. These paratroops had landed behind the Atlantic Wall defenses. The Nazi-operated Paris radio, quoting a last-minute flash from the battlefield, as the Germans put it, say that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. 600 naval guns opening fire on the French coastal stretch west of Le Havre laid down a mighty barrage of 2,000 tons of shells each 10 minutes, beginning at 5:15 a.m. today, British time, as the Allied invasion of Europe began. Apparently taken by surprise, the Germans replied from under a smoke screen laid down by our aircraft to Hutt. The red glare of flint enveloped targets. This comes from Pierre Huss, who is representing the combined American press. Covered by the tornadic bombardment, British assault troops successfully stormed ashore at 7:30 a.m. and were clearing the beaches by 7:45. Beginning at 7 a.m., one of the most sustained bombardments struck. It must have stunned the Germans and apparently silenced the majority of the shore batteries. The Luftwaffe was absent. The Allied air forces appear to have complete sky mastery. During the night, minesweepers cleared wide passages for the fleet, and then destroyers daringly escorted landcraft to shore while overhead airborne paratroops passed intermittently. And now here in our New York studio, to give you an analysis of the situation as it appears to him at the moment, is Columbia's analyst, Quincy Howe.
The news of these Allied landings on the north coast of France has given the war its most drastic sudden change since the Germans invaded Russia. Up to less than 12 hours ago, the Russians and the Russians alone had engaged and defeated millions of German troops in vast land battles. Our North African and Italian campaigns had diverted some German strength from Russia, so had our preparation for invasions from the West. The fall of Mussolini in July and the fall of Rome day before yesterday kept German prestige hard throughout Europe. But until Anglo-American troops began to land in force in the West, it was toward the Russians that the Germans looked with fear, and it was toward the Russians that the people of the occupied countries looked with hope. Our landings have started to change all that, and the better and faster our campaign in the West develops, the more rapidly British and American prestige will grow in Western Europe. These landings differ from the invasion of Italy in at least two important respects. First, they show that Britain and the United States have developed first-rate military power on land, as well as in the air and on the sea. We're now able to come to grips with the Germans in their own element, that's land fighting, having already mastered our two elements, the air and the sea. The campaign in Italy amounted to little more than a dress rehearsal compared with the scale of the present attack. Then, in the second place, these landings in France represent our first attempt at real liberation as compared with invasion. Although the Italian people had little liking for Mussolini and nothing but hatred for the Germans, the French people went into the war against the Germans and have lived under German domination for the past 4 years. Just as the landings in Europe will demonstrate the military power and skill of Britain and America, so these same landings will demonstrate the popular following and the fighting power that the underground resistance movement has developed in France and perhaps in other countries of Western Europe, too, for these other countries have also received notification that the liberation has begun.